accession number 19990, reel 15.
Chief Technician Roper, reel 15. You're saying that there was some servicing that had to be done on the aircraft according to calendar date.
Yes, so the idea was we only have the four, they were all in the hangar, they were folded up, and the engines had been inhibited. And so we knew that on leaving Plymouth, we wouldn't have to touch any of them before we got east of Aden. So
did you have to do any modifications to them before you went out for Far Eastern conditions?
I think we were all right. The modification, we had no problem. But as deck cargo on the Bulwark, we had, I think it was two Belvederes that were en route to Aden. Because there was problems in Aden, and there were 66 squadron in Aden, there was a Belvedere flight there that needed these aircraft. So, for convenience, they were put on board, and there was a chief tech in charge of the Belvederes, and we had to assist him because he was virtually on his own. So when we got to Aden, we helped them prepare them to get those ready to fly off. However, also on board the Bulwark, there was an exercise that was going to North Africa, and it was an army exercise with Marines. I know we had Kirky Battery Royal Artillery on board and one or two other people, but the snag was that when we got to Malta, and we weren't landing, we just took on mail at Malta, and then we took the Marines across to drop them in North Africa. But the sea state was exceptional for the Mediterranean, plus the fact we were delayed because King Idris had decided to abdicate. And to put an exercise of Marines ashore in North Africa at the time would have probably caused a diplomatic incident because Gaddafi was taking over. And so the exercise was cancelled, which meant that we had to take these Marines and drop them at Malta to be flown home from the exercise they hadn't been able to do. But at the last minute, King Idris said, "Oh, I won't abdicate till next week. Come and have your exercise." And, you know, I don't want to think you must have been a decent sort of a chap. So we had to go back to drop these Marines. And the snag was that the sea was so high that they wrote off all the landing craft and nearly some of the Marines getting them ashore.
Do you remember exactly where it was that they were trying to make their landing?
No, I don't. We weren't as far along as Al Adam. It was sort of this end of Libya,
the western end of Libya,
yes, as far as I remember. But we wrote off all the landing craft trying to get the Marines ashore, and they were lucky that there was nobody drowned. And so the Navy left a chief PO and a working party to try and do something with the Marine craft, but we had to sail on. It was getting sort of desperate that we sail on.
You were needed out
in the Far East. But as we got to the eastern end of the Mediterranean, trouble flared in Cyprus, and the Bulwark was diverted to Cyprus to take off all the Marit families. We, of course, were just eager to get out to where we were going, but the sailors thought this was going to be good fun, you see, with all the Marit families on board. But at the last minute, the UN decided to go into Cyprus, and so we were back on course.
It sounds like they were going to turn the Bulwark into a sort of ark, you know.
Yeah. Well, we then We got to the entrance to the canal, which hadn't been reopened long, and as we were the biggest thing afloat in the Mediterranean, we were first of the queue to go south through the canal. At this time, one of the naval cooks was stabbed by a young cook, and there was a bit of a panic to get him into hospital, and it was decided that they'd full steamed through the canal to Aden to get this man into hospital. I remember that there were dozens of sailors queuing to give blood, and the chap was made comfortable. He'd been stabbed in the stomach, and the young lad that had done it was in the brig.
Did you know why it had happened? What had caused it?
Yes, the young cook, and he was only probably 17, had been making custard, and he'd got this sort of bucket, stainless steel bucket full of scalding hot, clean water, and was just about to make his custard when this big chap, who wasn't much older but was a lot bigger, stuck his mop in the custard bucket. And the young lad had then had to go and take his bucket to wash it at the plate wash on the in the galley. And what he said was, he was washing it and the other implements, and this chap had set something to him, and he turned round and he had a carving knife in his hand, and the chap walked onto it. That I think the lad was in fear of, he'd insulted the bigger boy who was probably going to thump him. Anyway, the lad ended up with a serious stomach wound, which needed an operation and a lot of blood. And the surgeon on board fixed him up. But he pulled round and everything was more or less all right, except that the person had to sleep with his back upright in a sitting position. And he would keep sliding down to make himself more comfortable. And it was decided that the facilities for looking after him in Aden were not as good as those in the Far East. And he was kept on board because they thought he'd do better in the Far East. But sadly, he died off the coast of Ceylon. He was buried at sea. And of course the young lad was then up for murder. At this time we got diverted. There was a brushfire war going on in somewhere, Mombasa I think it was, and we were diverted there. And we were starting to wonder whether we'd ever get to the Far East. But eventually that problem was solved and we're back on course for Singapore.
Did this endless diversion and delay cause any problems with morale amongst your own chaps?
No, the worst problem was the sailors. They're used to, I thought they were used to being at sea for months, but
yes.
Because they hadn't been ashore in Malta, we got ashore in Aden, which was very good, and they all came on board with the usual, they call them rabbits, we call them gifts or presents. And we'd been entertained at the RAF Steamer Point Sergeant's Mess for a number of the people I was with. Aden, it relieved the tension a little bit. Also, of course, at Aden we met the Albion, who was on the way home. And we took on board all her Chinese cooks and laundrymen. And we watched as there was dozens and dozens of Tiger barrels rolled aboard the Hermes, and we thought we're going to be all right. The Bulwark, rather. Rolled aboard the Bulwark, we thought, oh, we're going to have some decent beer from now on. But sadly, they were all empty. And
taking back the empties, right?
Taking back the empties from the Albion. And she had, I remember, she was bedecked with paying off pennants. They had flags all over the place. All their sailors were in white uniforms, and all ours were still in the UK type uniform. So we knew the difference. You could tell the ones that were all brown like the officers' children and in these white suits. But we soldiered on. Just before we got to, well, we were in the Straits of Malacca, it was decided to fly off a casualty on one of the naval helicopters. Sadly, he had an engine failure, and the chap was strapped into the stretcher in the back, and it went into the water, and unfortunately they couldn't get the chap out of the back, so
he went down with the helicopter.
That was unknown to us at the time. We got to Singapore, and they demanded that I fly off all four Whirlwinds. Now, I knew that they just wanted one Whirlwind with the maximum amount of flying hours, fitted with Nord, because we only had a few that were fitted, and that it was to be used for training purposes. And
who made this demand then, that you should fly off all four? Putting this
it,
to you,
it came from Singapore. Now,
yes.
There was myself. I at the time was a sergeant. Mm. I had a corporal and a couple of airmen that were with me, and then I had the flight lieutenant, who hadn't to be troubled. But I was receiving these orders from the captain or from the officer of the watch. And of course it was a bit awkward to say, I want to query this order, because my instructions were that they would require one aircraft, the last aircraft I'd put into the hold, and that it was required with the maximum flying hours so that they could do the training for firing the Nord. And the pilots would have been taken from Borneo one at a time to do the training on Nord and then flown back. Anyway, it came through, you will disembark all four aircraft, which gave us a lot of trouble. So we got the aircraft ashore, and I remember having a confrontation with the technical records people over my 700s. They weren't used to them. They were finding faults that weren't there.
What are 700s?
Well, the 700 is the logbook for the aircraft. And these things, wherever the aircraft is, this book is there, and it records all the component numbers, how many hours they've flown on fitment, when they've got to be changed. And so every day you go through your 700, and normally there are markers so that you know that the that you've got 10 hours left to a minor or 17 hours left to a major or what have you. And also all the flying hours at which an artificial horizon may be time X at aircraft hours 2000. And if you've exceeded that, or if you need to change it and you haven't got one, you have to extend these hours and so on. And this is the log where everything's kept. It's the pilot signs it every flight. And also, if there are any things that you're living with, that say you've lost wheel cover or something silly, there'll be a red line entry saying this aircraft is serviceable to fly without carrying a wheel cover or whatever. And so the first thing you look at are the red line entries, which are to attract your attention to some limitation or extension that's been given. And I knew that my 700s were up to date, all the servicings had been done and so on. But because the Far East aircraft, Far East Air Force, operated different systems to the UK and to 38 Group, they pulled these 700s apart and were calling up all sorts of work to be done that didn't require it. So we wasted a lot of man hours taking off four aircraft. I left them with the one that I would have given them anyway, which was the new aircraft we'd bought from Westlands. And I flew my three squadron aircraft back on board the Bulwark and sailed off to Kuching. Off the coast of Kuching at a place near Santobol, on board came the CO, the same gentleman that I'd been with in El Adam, and we'd taken on a pilot in Singapore, that a newly trained pilot that had been flown out to Singapore to meet the Bulwark. And I, of course, I had the flight lieutenant that was recovering from his breakdown, and I think the CO plus one came on board. I think the pilot that had come out from UK stayed in Singapore, that was it. And we had a sergeant pilot join us at Singapore, and then the CO and a Polish pilot came out to join us on the Bulwark to fly the three remaining aircraft off. There was a problem when we flew off. The CO was going to lead us in formation across to Kuching, and my pilot, we had a resonance. The aircraft, if it's slightly out of balance, starts to sort of rock on its wheels, and it was quite a serious rock. And of course, you've got the movement of the carrier anyway. And eventually this was developing, and the pilot that I was flying with, which was the young sergeant, he says, "I'm not staying here, it's getting uncomfortable." So without the authority of the Flyco, who's the naval director of operations, he lifted off and took himself over the side of the ship, because he couldn't stay there any longer with this sort of resonance we've got. In the meantime, the CO took off, and the Polish pilot, and the CO sort of called for 1.5 spans, which meant he wanted quite a tight formation. Well, the young pilot wasn't too happy at flying too close to the one in front, and the old Polish pilot, who was an old hand, sort of... he came alongside us and he put three fingers up, meaning three spans. That's as close as you get. So we flew to Kuching, and there began my tour at Kuching.
What's a span? Is it the length of the aircraft?
The span of the diameter of the rotor blade, you see.
Right.
And believe me, things always look closer. You know, when you're within 6 foot of the cliff, actually it's something like 60 foot, but... Yeah. This 1.5 span, he meant 1.5 times the diameter, which is fairly tight. You know, it's all right for the red arrows, but not for helicopters that bob around like corks and are prone to having all sorts happen.
Was there any trouble about that once you arrived?
No. I think, you know, the greater experience of the Polish pilot was sort of...
Did you know about his history and background?
No, he later became a civilian pilot, but he had a lot of hours, and he'd been on bombers, because I believe he was one of the pilots that flew the Lancasters for the Dam Buster film, but that's just by the way.
They're mentioning the... Nord SS-11 missile. What kind of missile was that?
It was a fly-by-wire missile. In the Whirlwind, the pilot flies in the right-hand seat and the navigator or the operator in the left-hand seat, and he had a little joystick, and we used to have a simulator for this Nord, which I seem to remember having a go on. But it's a missile that goes off with a wire, and you fly it ahead of the aircraft like a model aeroplane, and all you can see is the glow from the rear of the rocket. And what they used to do was drop a parachute, US parachute, onto the jungle canopy, take the aircraft three or four, probably half a mile away, so that you could see the parachute, and just fly the thing and pop it into the parachute, and this is how you got the practice. But there was a simulator too, because they were obviously fairly expensive things.
What was it intended to be used against, this missile?
Well, if you had say a cave or a stronghold somewhere, you could actually fly this missile and put it into the target.
Was it originally designed for that, or was it originally an anti-tank missile or an anti-helicopter missile?
I presume it could be used for anything, but of course a helicopter is a sitting target, and you know, with one bullet in those days, if it hit the wrong spot, I mean, we did have a helicopter shot down in the early days, which I'll come to a little bit later on, but you were a sitting target. But if you knew that there was a stronghold or a particularly things like caves,
yes,
then you could fly the thing into the hillside. And
how many of these could a whirlwind carry?
I think there were we never used them in anger, but there were, I think you carried four.
What sort of range did they have?
Once again, I think it had to be in visual range. But as it was on a wire, I would imagine the wire wasn't all that long, you know. So ideal for sort of, I would think up to a quarter of a mile, possibly, would be a guess.
How big a bang did it produce once it?
I don't know. I never saw one fired in anger, although most of the training, of course, was done in the Malay jungle. And as I say, although we carried them on occasions, they were never used in anger as far as I remember.
Now, while you were at LADM, did you have anything to do with the army yourself?
No.
Did you have any direct connection?
No.
What about on the bulwark when you were going out? Did you
Because I was known to be going the furthest to Kuching, they made me responsible for one of the sergeant's messes. Now, the Bulwark is a marine carrier, so they have a number of sergeant's messes, and they have a PO's mess and a chief PO's mess. And I was responsible for one of the sergeant's mess, and in it were this... they wore marine berets, and they were called Kirky Battery Royal Artillery, and they'd been in America, and they had what they call 1.5 howitzers, and they were a crack team. They were the posh bit, but they were all wearing marine berets and presumably attached to them. But
these were commando gunners then.
Yes. But what they whilst we were at sea, they threw 50-gallon drums over the side and had target practice, and I remember falling foul of their officer in charge, because each of these guns was manned by a junior officer, a lieutenant or second lieutenant, and there were sergeants and corporals sort of doing the loading and the aiming and so on. And I remember that, I don't know whether he was a captain or a major that was in charge of them, but back in the mess, I sort of got hold of one of these sergeants, and he was sort of saying, well, what did you think to our display today? And I said, well, I thought it was shocking, because I said, in the Air Force, you would never get an officer addressing a junior officer in front of his men in the way your CO addressed the young lieutenant there, you see. Anyway, this sergeant apparently went and told his CO that the RAF chap said it was bad form to address down an officer in front of his men. And we had a long argument, the officer and I, but he didn't convince me that it was the right thing to do, and I said, well, in the Air Force he would have been taken on one side and given a thorough dressing down. I said, but the Army do things differently.
How did you get on with the army generally, with the people who were living in your mess at that time?
Oh, very well. The thing was, you see, that most ships are dry. You can't. They get the rum, but that's all they get. But the Bulwark was different. She had an Afi on board, and the senior NCOs and officers were allowed to drink during off-duty periods. And I, running the officers, the sergeant's mess that I'd got, 4P3A mess was the mess, I had a large fridge, and I could fill it full of beer, and this was sold to the mess members and replenished whenever. I also held the jug for the rum, and this you used to go and fill up at 11 o'clock every morning, and you had to prove how many you had in the mess. I think I had 11. And there was always the odd teetotaler, or in most occasions they would say, it's so-and-so's birthday, does anybody mind if we add a tot, you see? And they usually, well, there was a Coke machine in the aisleway on this ship, and we'd get a cup of Coke and put it in with the 11 tots of rum, which would make it up to about 13 tots. And what used to happen was, if anybody was bottling, and a lot of the Marines bottle, theirs is taken out of when it's neat, and it's put into a bottle, their own bottle, and then the rest is dished out. But if it's watered down with the Coke, it's usually somebody's birthday and they give him the extra tot. And believe me, although I got on board not particularly enjoying rum, when you're at sea and you're getting that fresh air at 11 o'clock when the rum comes up, it gives you a good sort of start before your lunch. And I got into the habit, and fortunately when I was on this trip, we spliced the main brace twice, which for the Navy is unusual for them to splice the main brace. One was for the birth of Prince Andrew, and the other was the Queen's birthday, and it just so happened that it fell between these dates. And then of course we had, as I say, we had a murder on board, we had two splicings of the main brace, and I was the most popular chap on the ship as regards the naval side, because in the Navy, when you your time is up and you're a chief PO, so that you don't hold anybody's promotion up, you lose your rank, so you become a PO, but you're paid as a chief PO. And all these old POs that were chiefs, sort of demoted, used to come round, and I'd get them at any hour of the day coming to check the central, air conditioning or the water supply or something. And of course it was on the excuse, because they knew I had a fridge full of beer that could be got at. And so we did a good trade in cans of beer and stuff, but it was a very pleasant trip, and you got a chance to go round the ship and see what people did. And the worst place, of course, we were on a carrier, I think it was capable of 30 knots or something, and when you went down into the engine room and saw the conditions those poor so-and-sos have to work in, They had things that looked like a stirrup pump, and they plugged them in as they needed more power. They plugged these stirrup pumps into the turbine or whatever it was that operated it. And so if you were at full steam, all the stirrup pumps were plugged in and switched on. And the heat, there were catwalks around this huge engine room, and on the catwalks were fans which blew the hot air onto you instead of letting you just soak up the thing. And these poor chaps, after a shift down there, literally crawled up the steps out of the engine room to reach the cold water machine. And you felt like sort of getting a cup of cold water and taking it down to them, but they were literally crawling up on their hands and knees to get to the water machine. It was quite a grueling
besides the entertainment of the murder and the rum and the beer, what could you do to keep yourself occupied on the voyage?
Next door to the mess I ran was the corporal's mess, and